When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
We go somewhere, you know, and you say, what part of Ireland did you come from? And I mean, we don't think of it speaks like Irish or whatever, but you'll ask, say, what part of Ireland did you come from? So I went up to the festival, to Mariposa, we're up there, and I was talking to one. And I said, what part of Ireland did you come from? I said, honey, I was never in Ireland. But the crowd here nearly everyone talks like the Irish people. Yeah. They said to go to Ireland, you know, they're just the same as the crowd here talking.
And we knew about Ireland. The Irish knew very, very little about us because it had been chopped off. No communications. We were poor and struggling. And there was more pizzazz with the term Irish American. The Irish used to say the next parish to Ireland was Boston or New York. And it's not so. It's St. John's.
I've seen places in Ireland that are not nearly as what is accepted to be Irish as this place.
The traditional conception of the Irish in North America is they came to North America but the arse out of their pants, right? Well, the Irish who came to Newfoundland came long before the famine. They entered the trades, they entered the fishery, they became merchants. They did very well, thank you very much. And they put a lot into this community. They also brought a lot back to places like Waterford and Youghal and Wexford, New Ross, you know. The Newfoundland fishery, people don't bother going 40 days in one direction across the stormy North Atlantic to get to a place like Newfoundland unless there's some kind of a reward at the end of it. And yes, there was real wealth to be derived.
The Irish connection to Newfoundland goes back to actually 1683. It was the first record I could find of an Irish, apart from St. Brendan, this, you know, this legend that St. Brendan came over. But apparently in 1683, there was a man living on an island off the coast of Newfoundland near Trinity Bay called Ireland's Eye. Now, his name I don't know, but it was, that's the first official record. A lot of Irish came to Newfoundland after the Wexford Rebellion between 1798 and 1825.
Over 90% of the Irish coming to Newfoundland over two centuries or so of time came from, or roughly within 20 miles of Waterford City, the hinterland of Waterford, which would include centres such as New Ross, small towns such as Greadnamana and Inisteague and Thomastown and Callan and Carrickinshore, but not, for example, the city of Kilkenny, which is too far north. So it's a very limited, very focused migration basin. what is more, that continued to be the source area for labour and for migrations for a century and a half of time. People leaving over generations, so that migration is not kind of a sudden rush, like the famine migration that just has a very short duration. It's rather a tradition of moving over generations from a particular place, a townland or a parish, so that it was handed down as a habit, and they knew about the place for many, many generations. And that's unusual.
And the great-grandfather built this house here that we're living in now for his son Tim. The great-grandfather died in 1855. So we take it that the house was settled by the family around 1855. And Tim then became, by the standards of those days, Tim became fairly wealthy. He became a shopkeeper and a keeper of horses or trucks, preceded the motorised ways of conveyance. So he was fairly well off. And then he inherited this house, and the great-grandfather, the builder of this house, left the house to Tim, who in turn left it to my grandfather, his brother Michael. Then another brother, Patrick, acquired some land a mile from here. And by the way, that place is being developed now. It was a very, very lovely farm years ago. And Tim's wife was an Irish speaker. And it's from her that my father had some Irish and had a great reverence for the Irish language. Her name was Margaret Barry, known as Peggy Barry. Mm-hmm. They did some farming, but there were large families in those days, and usually farm 4 or 5 acres of cleared land, mm-hmm, out of grant of 43, couldn't sustain a whole family. There were 12 children. Bit by bit they married and went to live, some in St. John's and some in the States. A few of them died early. And the area was totally Irish. Our nearest neighbours, they were Wickhams. They were from Adamstown, County Wexford. Then just beyond them were the O'Leary's. And just across the river were O'Dwyer's. And beyond that was Boggins. And about 25 families settled in this area. And it was notable that the whole suburbs, really, from 10 miles, we say, of suburbs, they were all settled by Irish farmers. How they must have waited for spring. Yeah. And they keeping their cattle housed, stabled from November to May, and how they had to provide for them. Yeah. You come into an area we covered with those monster, we call them that, spruce trees, spruce and fir. Have to get those out of the ground first, and it cultivates a little area, and bit by bit they cultivated some acreage. There were no extensive farms among the Irish.
My great-grandmother, she came from County Wexford in Ireland. Yeah, her name was Bridget Power. Used to call her Biddy, Irish Biddy, that's what she's go by the name. Her husband now, my grandfather, he was an Esh. And on my mother's side, my grandfather came from County Cork. He was a Caffey. But anyway, nearly everyone around this place came from Ireland, you know, their ancestors came from Ireland. But they said, you know, they were great musicians. They could sing or play or doing. It was always a good time here at the Main Branch. With all different kind of choral music and singers. Oh, they were the best. They could sing. And we lived then in Branch. I was born in 1924. And we lived there. And we had a nice. But then, in them times, in days, it was hard to get to fishing, you know. The way you said, just a dory, and the way you'd have to go out, I mean, it was really hard. And not like it is today. Them times, you had a skull and oar, and you had skiffs for to get out to the guy. And sometimes the skiffs would get, you know, they'd run aground, and you had it real hard for to get out, you know, and open boats. And you'd know such thing as boiling a kettle. Just have a little thing, a little kettle, they call a boat's kettle. And you'd have your bread in that so the sea wouldn't get wet, you know. And you'd have a kettle, they'd boil it when you get out fishing, they'd make a little fire on the boat. You know, they'd have a little tin pan and put the fire in, boil the kettle out there. And they'd have fishing. But then the fish was plenty that time. But they used to only get a small price for it. They'd have to send for the supplies in the boats. And the big boat is here coming. Whenever we see the boat come, then they'd all go down, you know, for expecting their supplies. They go down, and when they get the supplies, then, oh, everyone be glad to come in and to get it on. And them times, like now, no trouble to get drink or rum rank. You get one bottle of rum. That's what you get for the whole year, to keep that for Christmas. And they'd have it. You know, they thought that was good for get them times, so hard to get. So. But one thing they used to have them times, just make the big keg of beer, you know, with the yeast cake, the molasses. And sometimes just have the beer made with hops. You get in a peck and it boil and put in. But mostly yeast cake and molasses. And leave it work for so many days. And you have that for Christmas. And they all just enjoy themselves. Crowd going around singing and telling stories and everything. But that's the way they used to live them times. And what I'd be wondering, we have so much things now, turn on the switch, run, turn, and still and all, nobody have time to speak. That's what I can't understand. You'll meet him, oh, yeah, I've got time now to run. I'll see you later, and you'd never lay eyes on him again.
What I like about Branch so much is the characters here. Really, like, there's a whole string of communities. You've driven out now today, you've driven out the Cape Shore, and you're coming out from Placentia, right down along the coast, all the different communities, Patrick's Cove and Cusslet, St. Bride's, and Angel's Cove. But this would be the place that was so rich in storytelling and singing, you know, the music. Everybody's known here for, I don't know, except me. Couldn't carry a note in a bucket. Couldn't sing to save yourself. But my and my mother's side from out the road, they would all be a very musical family. The O'Rourkes, my father used to torment her, Jaswell. You know, she was a tinker somewhere way back, so no wonder she's so fond of being on the go all the time and singing and playing. But it's a fishing community. Still is a fishing community, even after round one and round two of the moratorium. We would define ourselves as a fishing community. You know, I mean, you can look across and we live right in the bay. And people would be tied to the sea. Every family is somehow tied to the sea, either they're fishing or they're, you know, somebody in their family is fishing or they're working on shore, you know, tangled up with the fishery. Not so much my family. We're probably the exception. I grew up on a farm here, on the farm, with the sheep and the cows and a few horses and a few hens just to pasture yourself so you wouldn't have to go to the store and buy eggs. And, you know, we have all of our own. We're primarily a farming, grew up in a farming sort of an environment. But as you can see around, it's not the kind of community you want to be doing a lot of farming in. It's not really conducive to, it's not agricultural land here. And I would say it's most like parts of Donegal. Donegal and Connemara. You know, right out the west of Connemara. And the most northwesterly parts of Donegal. It's rough, it's rocky. Lots of bays and inlets along, you know, around this area. And it's very hilly. So you have plenty of trees and, you know, you can see where people have cleared off the land here. But, I mean, as you can see, just looking across, I'm living here. We're sitting here in the Easter Cove, it's called. And you look over across at the light, the last one over the Wester Cove. And I remember sitting, gosh, I think it was somewhere out in Galway. I can't remember exactly the place it was. It was not too far from Roundstone, anyway. I remember sitting down there and I was just driving along the coast, driving in, and you just come up over the hill and you look down. You look down into the community and the whole community is right along. And I thought, you know, it's just like home. That would be most like the landscape, the people. Here were mostly Powers and Nashes, McGraths. That's, you know, what Branch is known for. The first fellow to come over here from Ireland was a Nash. And he came over, Nashes and Powers were the first. So I suppose now you could trace Meebeck on both sides to one or the other of those families' power, obviously. And it'd be my name.
A big crowd into me mommers come. And they step in back at the door. They say, can the mommers come in? And they say, yes. Oh, the big crowd would come in. And they'd have a accordion or they'd have a mouth organ. And all of the mats, there's a mats on the floor, all of the mats on the bare floor. And they'd dance and dance. And when they go, if you had a drop of beer or whatever they'd have, they'd all have a drink of beer or whatever. And they'd have a good time. And there's really good singers in at that time. And they had these really good songs. They sit down and they dance and sing. Then they say, now the mommers have to go now. And they go to nearly every house. And by the time they get to the last house, we get to midnight, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. This house is some good. Oh, cutting around the corner with my old rag and do. And I met a little flaxy-headed girl one day. Good morning, little flaxy-headed, to her, I'd say. Good morning, little beggar man. How do you do with your rags and your jags and your old rag and do? You sing that, and I'll just have a really good time. Especially them old fellas. They'd have songs now you'd never get to know about. But when Christmas comes, they'd all sing. And then you mightn't sing it till the next Christmas again. Somebody else, we sell it good. There's all kinds of different Irish songs. And there were one about, did you ever go into an Irishman's shanty where the water was scarce and the whiskey was plenty? A two-legged stool and a table to match, a stick in the door instead of a latch.
My mother's people were surname English, and they were from somewhere in the Cumras or Comerigs, my grandfather called it. But Kareens, they could have come from anywhere, and they always maintained their Irishness, like all the rest of them out in the Cape Shore, who were of 100% Irish extraction. Yeah, somewhere around 1820, they came, two brothers came out. The story was that one of them went back and afterwards brought his mother out. But things are lost, and the first generation struggled, the second generation struggled, the third generation struggled here, and the fourth. He had the elements some years. Lack of fish, it was only really one side of the economy, and that was fish. A lot of immigration to the States, people gave up. They hung on here. There was only particular different breaks they had. Like Patrick's Day was a great break during Lent. Fellas get the pledge list, you know, who had been guilty of drinking and went over to the priest to get the pledge. And they used to get it lifted for Christmas or get it lifted for Patrick's Day or Lady Day, August 15th. That was another big day here. A lot of people used to fish half days for the church.
The unofficial church had always been here, had been coming out with the fishermen, but you know, and these itinerant priests. But it was, in fact, a group of merchants who invited James Louis O'Donnell, who was an Irish Franciscan, to come out to Newfoundland and sort of formally establish the church. And that happened in 1784. So there was a substantial number of Irish in Newfoundland by that point who really had been to-ing and fro-ing and coming back and forth in the migratory fishery, but in fact had stayed and become a permanent community here. So once the numbers sort of warranted, they decided, well, all right, it's worth sending someone out. And O'Donnell came out, so that was 1784. And that was about a month before Baltimore was established. So this would have been, this is in fact, in terms of the church, this is the oldest English-speaking Roman Catholic diocese in North America. They were all indeed supposed to be able to speak Irish, because most of the people, most of the ordinary fisher people, fisher folk, did speak Irish and Irish Gaelic.
The cod fishery was an English language enterprise. It was managed by merchants who were from the west country of England and by English planters, their descendants, and it was the language of commerce. And much like, I suppose, English spread westwards in Ireland in the 17th and 18th centuries, Irish in Newfoundland disappeared with the generation that brought it, the immigrants. They would learn their English in Newfoundland. Well, it's interesting in terms of accent how Newfoundland dialects, varieties of English might have developed. it's possible that the Irish accent that you get in Newfoundland would be rooted in Wexford, because they, after all, spoke English before they left. It could hardly be rooted in West Waterford or even South Tipperary, because they simply did not have English. They would have learned it here. They could learn it from earlier Irish settlers already established here, and many, I'm sure, did, the later people who came. The first Irish who came, and Irish migrants who could not speak English, worked for English masters or planters, and one would imagine that they would have accents like their English masters, which would therefore be Devonshire or Dorset or Bristol, West Country. And we find that today in mixed communities where English and Irish share a harbour, and they're very numerous. And the disappearance of the Irish language in Newfoundland with the death of the immigrants created a kind of a vacuum, a cultural vacuum, and that the Catholic Church and Catholicism itself more or less colonized that space, cultural space.
Speaking Irish, my father had some, which he learned from Margaret Barley. But Irish wasn't taught here. I had a liking for it because of my father. And we even studied a little bit, he and I. And I remember getting some records of Irish songs from Linguaphone. And my father was quite emotional about when he heard them first. That's a nice poem. It does refer to this wild land, and it's a blessing from here to there. I know a little bit of it. Yes. An I to dar weaving bin go hen, mar half crit queen, queen of well, machas, a ve mille again, o van knick head no.
The main culture of Newfoundland is very much based on Irish, like the music and the drama, the dancing, all of these things. If you trace them back, you'll find that they come from Irish roots. And the cultural part, especially in Newfoundland, is a reflection, really, of Irish culture, more so than English and Scotch. There's some, and it intermingles, it's a little different. But there is a large part of it is based on the Irish thing. And, of course, we have our story. We still believe, you know, over here, there are people still believe in the little people, the good people. If you go up the southern shore of Newfoundland, which is basically Irish, you will find that people will talk to you about anything else. But if you bring up the fairies or good people, they will not talk about them. They're still afraid that something will happen, right? And they'll still point out to you places where there are fairy paths, fairy rings, and God help you if you build your house on a fairy path, because it will be moved. We have a lot of stories of people out berry picking or gathering wood or something, who've been hit a fairy breeze has hit them and carried them something like 40 miles from where they're to. Firmly believe this is, and people will tell you that. And if some, there are stories of children being lost and being taken by the fairies and kept and then returned, but they were never really the same after. My sister lives in Placentia. She did a little bit of home care for a while, and one of the patients in the house where she was working, my sister got to know her a bit and talk to her a bit. So eventually she loosened up and she told her that she'd been carried off by the fairies when she was young, and she showed her one of her breasts had withered, and this was the fairy mark.
When there was no radios, there was no televisions, There was no telephones. There was no nothing. And they tell a big story and you get real frightened. And they tell it so creepy that if you went outside a door and a cat or a dog rubbed it, this would fall down a pile. You get such a fright. Yeah, they used to tell real ghost stories. Oh, God, it's them so good they really think that there was someone there. But they used to believe a lot in the fairies that time. They used to, and they tell stories. I remember when I used to go out and my grandma would say, be sure that you have bread in your packet. And she said, you have to be stale bread. She said, don't go with fresh bread here. She said, stale bread in your packet, because she said, for the fairies will take you. She said, the fairies, she said, you know, their favourite colour is green. And she said, if you go now, she said, you lose your way. She said, don't go by yourself. Bring someone, because the fairies will take you. And we are so frightened about the fairies. You get real good, then you start praying. So it's too late to pray now. Yeah. There was an old woman up here, Mrs. Mary Jo Mooney was her name. Mooney now they call her, but Mooney was the call that time. I said it's Mooney. And she used to go, had the cow, she had a big lot of cattle, you know. And she'd go milk her cows in the evening. She'd go way out over the bones, way out here. And she'd milk her cows. And this evening she was gone. And she heard the crowd singing. And they go, you know, and they had all little red caps on them. And they all used to go around, you know, around a big tree. And they go around, she heard them. And she thought they were singing out at her. She said, get on, you sassy thing, she said. You singing out at me, she said. Before you were born, she was a midwife, she said, I had to go over to the tent. She said, get on with you, she said, singing out at me. And they had red caps. But what she was wondering, they all had red caps. And they're going around, they singing. But they didn't do anything to her. She just went down. She went down, she milked her cows. And she'd bring the big bucket of milk, big pail of milk home. And strange, she'd go in the woods. But when she come home, she's saying about the sassy young one, she said, singing out at her. But she went to the fairies. They had red caps and green, and they danced around and played. And the same time around, at the same time, there was an old man used to live away down by the raid out here in the cove, you know, right down the river. And his name was Dick English. And he used to stay by himself. And he had an old shack, an old door. He used to latch the door on the inside and used to go to sleep and lie down. So this night he was lying down, he's smoking away at his pipe, not mine. And he put down his pipe and he'd go to sleep. So finally he heard the door opening and he heard knocking the door, and he never spoke and he kept it still. And he saw the little ones coming in, little fairies coming in, and he had a whistle he used to play in the evening, and he had it up on his door. And he heard them getting up, getting the whistle. And he come down. And they start playing the tune. But he was listening. And he played the tune and they danced and they ran down. So when he finished, he put up the whistle on the door. And they went out and they latched the door again. And when they were gone, he got up. And he went playing the tune that the fairies played. And he played it so good that that was the tune. And he played that tune. And over in Ireland or anywhere, no one could never have that tune. Whatever he played, no one ever heard the tune before.
Ye lads and lassies of Newfoundland, come listen to my tale. Until I relate the hardships great I spent in St. John's jail. Although I'm a prisoner in this land, I'll do the best I can to relate the hardships I did inspire in the prison of Newfoundland. On the 28th day of October last, to the country first I came. On a pretty brig from Ballymore, the Paragram by name. We were consigned unto Harvey's Wharf, our cargo therefore to land, which causes me bitterly to regret my voyage to Newfoundland. Now the day of my trial, it begrieved my heart full sore. For to see one there at a liberty, who falsely on me swore, The judge, he found me guilty, and those words I heard him say. 4 months on bread and cold water in the penitentiary. Now when my trial was over, then they marched me right away down to that penitentiary, my winter there to stay. 'Twas there I met comrades plentiful, as you may understand, to be fed on bread and cold water in the prison of Newfoundland. Now this jail was situated by the side of a lonely pond, where oftentimes I sat sitting there like the mockingbird alone, a-watching the lads and the lassies, how they used to sport and play to those iron gates and windows of the penitentiary. Now one night as I lay fast asleep all in my prison cell, I dreamt I was back in old Ireland where once I used to dwell. The pleasing dreams, they disturbed my rest, as you may understand. For alas, I woke with my heart a-broke in the prison of Newfoundland. Now to conclude and finish, I mean to end my song. Oh, Johnny Doyle, it is my name, and old Ireland I do belong. I spent all my time in them black ballines since ever I went to sea, and it's pretty soon I'll be going back to the land of liberty. I spent all my time in them black ballines since ever I went to sea, and now at last sure I'm caught fast to the penitentiary.
I grew up with songs and stories and everything, and everything, my God, all the songs and all the stories were all Irish. But I didn't have any expectation. You were asking me earlier, you know, what did I think of Ireland when I went over? I didn't have any expectation of what it was going to be like. I didn't think it was going to be, like you still find now, about parts of Connemara and parts of Donegal and certainly down around Cork. You certainly still find some of that. But that is the impression that many people had of Ireland. I remember when I got over there and you really, you know, size it up and think, God, there's an awful lot of crowd home. If they came over, they'd be some disappointed, because it's not at all what they grew up with and the songs and stories that they grew up with. God, I mean, you know, which is only fair and it's only right. My goodness, I mean, it's what would you expect? What else would you expect? Time moves on. It's just that here it didn't, you know, because here people grew up with, it's still the way it was when they left it. But as I said, you know, that's changing. And the world is definitely getting smaller all the time. And there's people now, young people now, just in this community of about 300 people, there's a good half a dozen of them, already been to Ireland. 16, 17 years old, and they've already been over to Ireland. People are travelling more, and they're seeing more. And I find that if you're in places like this now, if you're living in a place like this now, it's because you choose to, and you choose this way of life, and you want to stay here.
I can go to places like Carrick on Shore, or walk through the streets of Waterford, or Wexford, or New Ross, and you can instantly see that the architecture of those places is our architecture. The tongues and the accents and the voices that you hear are heard here. The way we say our words, the way we sort of think about things, our dry humor, much of our music, we have these connections to Europe. And there's no denying it. There's utterly no other place in North America that has that kind of set of connections. People say, oh, well, Newfoundland, the reason why we have this is because you existed in isolation. I would argue not. We traded with the world. We were the grand cod fishery of the universe. And if you go to the remote, most remote outports in Newfoundland, you will still find furniture and books, and you'll still find artifacts that obviously have come from other parts of the world. So we were not isolated. I'm not even sure we were culturally isolated. But we had our own dynamic, and that I think that is the difference. It wasn't the isolation that sort of gave us the culture or allowed us to sort of preserve our heritage or makes us similar to Europe. It's our own dynamic and the fact that we had our own dynamic, and we still do have our own dynamic. I think now in terms of our culture in Newfoundland and Labrador, as we now call ourselves, we're undergoing a renaissance. We're really immediately now starting to make the connections between all that scholarship that's been done on our connection with Ireland and, you know, the West Country of England, but especially Ireland, because it's been the neglected aspect. I mean, there was the first 30 years of professional Newfoundland history after Confederation concentrated on the West of England fishery, you know, and the original idea was, oh, the Irish came along to Newfoundland as helpmeets to the West Country fishing masters, you know. Then you have scholarship by people like John Mannion, you know. Oh, well, you know, there's 100 vessels coming out of Dublin in 1680, you know, and there's you know, we know it was the largest, most concentrated migration from any part of the Old World to any part of the New over the longest period of time. In any recorded human migration was the 60 miles around Waterford to the 100 miles around St. John's. And we're starting to realize that many of our institutions had their connections and roots with Ireland, even families. I was probably the first in my family to go back to Ireland. I developed an interest in Newfoundland history and then looking at the Irish in it and then Irish Newfoundland history, and then as a graduate student I went back to Ireland. I'd been the first person in my family to go back to Ireland since 1751 when they arrived from Thomastown.
Cultural links were not maintained except through the church. In other words, that priests would come to administer, Irish priests or Newfoundlanders. Irish Newfoundlanders would go to Dublin to All Hallows and Maynooth and be ordained and come back. But beyond that, there was hardly any link. So these people were cut off for a century and a half, from 1840 to the recent past. And we're now looking at generations 6, 7, 8 and 9 of Irish descent here. And it's only recent generations, people born since 1950, who have reconnected with Ireland and are learning through modern media, have been learning now for some time about Ireland. And that, in a sense, has heighten their awareness of their Irishness. So in a sense, there's a revival. You see this with music. As time went on, after the migrations, people lived on memory, and that memory, of course, has to fade in time over generations, and their image of Ireland by 1930, 100 years after the migrations ended, would be quite different to their image today because they know so much more about the place than their parents or grandparents, certainly.
St. Bridget's Cross, I got over there. You say about St. Bridget, you know, about her feast day, and how they go around from door to door bringing stuff, you know, different kind of vegetables or fruits or anything, and that she was a really good saint, St. Bridget. They didn't give me that cross. They didn't enjoy giving me that cross. I have this dear saint. She's in the house never burn. So I've leaves in that. I have no insurance on my house. I don't pay nothing because of St. Bridget's Cross. And I believe in that. And they used to have stories about Ireland. There was a big famine over in Ireland one time. And, I mean, a lot of people had to get out, you know, and live and go in different places.
My family, certainly the generation before, you know, when you grew up with the stories about Ireland, it was how terrible it was that they had to leave. And it was always, you know, the sadness of not going back. And I think that by the time I got to about my parents' generation, or certainly in my particular family anyway, with my mum and dad, it was none of that. You'd still consider it home, but this is home. You know, we've been here long enough to be putting down roots here. You know, we were growing up, certainly around here, these places, you're a Newfoundlander first, and then you're Irish, and then you're Canadian after that. So, you know, I found that interesting when people were talking about, you know, when I was recruiting people to go to work in Ireland. Sure, they'd sooner go to Ireland than to go to parts, other parts of Canada, because they felt more of a kinship with Ireland than with, you know, mainland Canada.
A lot of Newfoundland songs derive from Irish music, like Irish jigs, like, you know, like we have one called the Squidgic and Grounds, we have one which is Tatterjack Welsh, the jig Tatterjack Welsh. And we have a song called the Squidgic and Grounds, which is the very same air, you know. And another one, we have Tickle Cow Pan, which I forget the name of that Irish tune, but it's from another Irish tune anyway. We'll be playing that today too, so you can hear them, you know. Father and mother used to play the accordion, used to play the dances and lancers and quadrilles and that around the bays, you know. The bays had a lot of dancing, and they played the square dances and the lancers, jigs and reels and polkas, everything, anything that they could dance to, really, you know, they played. You know. And they played, sometimes they played a reel in jig time or something, but just to accommodate the dance, you know what I mean? How they did it, I don't know, but I'm sure they did it. They never had the radio or like we had it, so it was all passed down to them from the Irish forebears. And of course, the music changed over the years, you know, to suit their own standards. You know, the timing was lot faster than the Irish music. Perhaps they wanted to get it over with fast. I don't know why they played it so fast, but they did. And they also put little variations in the music, like an extra beat. Why they did it, I don't know, but I'll be playing one here today now where you can hear that extra beat in it.
Making the Newfoundland connection were box player Frank Marr, singer Christopher Young, farmer Ollie O'Brien, folklorist Mike McCarthy, historian John Fitzgerald, storyteller Mary Power, and businesswoman Nadia Power. We also heard from ex-fisherman Nick Kareen of Placentia and geographer John Mannion, once of Galway and for 40 years now of Memorial University, Newfoundland. Sound supervision for the programme was by Colm O'Rourke. The Newfoundland Connection was produced by Cathal Porter.
If you enjoyed this documentary, you might like to listen to our other Documentary on One productions. Visit rte.ie/docon1.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.